This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about incarceration and health. You can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. In the spring of last year, Adnan Khan's phone was blowing up. People were reaching out to him, desperate to bring attention to the conditions in prisons and jails as the coronavirus was spreading.
They didn't have masks, and they were putting T-shirts around their faces, tying T-shirts around their faces, and staff would be like, hey, take that off, or you'll get a write-up or disciplinary infraction. You're not allowed to cover your face.
His buddy, Anthony Ammons, called with news that he had tested positive for COVID. Anthony has been serving a sentence at San Quentin since he was a teenager. He works at the prison hospital. He told Adnan that even though he was exposed to the virus at work, he hadn't been allowed to shower after his shifts.
We're being told by COs that, oh, we'll get you tomorrow on the shower. We'll get you the next day on the shower. We'll get you the next day on the shower.
Adnan wanted to amplify what he was hearing. He took their conversation to Facebook Live until it came to an abrupt halt. A guard ordered Anthony to get off the phone.
Yeah, he just wrote my name down if I didn't get off the phone. So I'm getting in trouble and I want to get off the phone.
Bro, okay. All right, man. Hey, thanks for calling, bro. I apologize for what you're going through, man.
Thank you. I love you, man.
Love you too, bro. Tell Bonnaroo and them I said what's up.
Okay, bye.
All right.
Adnan was worried about his friend and all the others who were getting sick.
We kept hearing over and over and over that every 5 to 10 minutes, an alarm was going off. People couldn't breathe.
Adnan himself spent years at San Quentin, so he could hear this alarm system in his head.
You start yelling, or you have your cellmate or your neighbors yell, man down, man down. And then so you'll hear man down in whatever the cell number is, man down in 222 or 223, man down. And the whole building starts yelling that. That's our medical alarm.
Thousands of people inside of prisons and jails were getting sick with coronavirus, and conditions were dire for others as well.
If they didn't have COVID, they needed medicine. They needed their insulin. Because of COVID, they were very inadequate in providing that service as well. So it was like just an accumulation of the whole thing in terms of medical and inside corrections just falling on their face.
Coronavirus outbreaks have brought more attention than ever to health issues inside of American prisons and jails. But even outside of a pandemic, providing medical care in this setting has lots of challenges. Sojourner Ahebe reports.
Adnan Khan remembers being the sickest he'd ever been in his life while in prison.
I was lying in my bunk for 2-3 days. I couldn't eat. I couldn't turn to the right or left without excruciating pain.
But he didn't ask for help or medical care.
To nurse myself back to health was just drink water from the sink in my cell. Because I already knew after serving since I was 18, I grew up in prison, that the help that I needed, the medical would not be able to provide for me.
He didn't trust the system.
When you go to medical, they give you ibuprofen. That's like the common joke, but it's also like satirical, meaning that you can go in for whatever the situation is, and the most common response is, here, we're going to give you ibuprofen.
His symptoms subsided eventually, but he never got a diagnosis. At another point during his time in prison, Adnan remembers discovering a dime-sized bald patch on the back of his head that seemed to have appeared out of the blue. He was battling depression after an extended period of not seeing his family. So he went to get the spot checked out by a doctor.
They said, oh, it's alopecia, and here's a printout of what it is. There's nothing we can do.
Alopecia is a genetic autoimmune condition that can be triggered by severe stress. Looking back, Adnan says it was clear he needed mental health care, but that's not what he got. And on many levels, he says, health care and incarceration are just at odds.
It's really difficult to have medical treatment in a correctional facility in general. Ultimately, the people that make the decisions are correctional staff, and they can just say that we need to care about the safety and security of the people. And oftentimes that can eclipse an immediate like medical need.
Nick Scharf experienced that disconnect between care and incarceration too. He was a corrections physician for a few years, and also was chief of clinical services at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections until 2013. He started working in prisons at the end of his career, after spending more than 25 years working in traditional hospitals. It was a steep learning curve, so different from providing care in a community setting. Nick says one of the biggest challenges was scheduling medical appointments.
All movement has to be controlled and recorded. The prison has to know exactly where every inmate is at every instant of every day. And when inmates go to see somebody off-site, officers have to go with them. That has to be scheduled. There's got to be transport. It's got to be secure.
And sometimes, he says, mishandling of urgent care was an issue not of individual providers, but of upper management.
And I have seen cases time after time in various systems when, you know, a patient had a problem which was identified by a provider, and that provider did everything he could do to get that thing taken care of, but the medical director he reported to just didn't move it along. This patient needed to see a specialist, and the result was that the patient lost an organ.
Nick says this is a population that really needs care.
Inmates actually are very high users of medical services. They have had a lot of physical trauma, so they've got a lot of orthopedic problems, a lot of chronic pain. They have a lot of psychological trauma, and they have a real burden of other diseases, at least commensurate with the general population.
About 40% of incarcerated people have their chronic diseases diagnosed while in prison. And Nick says sometimes you see short-term health benefits.
If you're talking about somebody's hypertension or his diabetes, much better cared for in prison than they would have been if the guy were not in prison, in a good system. Look, nobody ever has to miss an appointment. Nobody ever has to miss a medicine. Nobody ever runs out of money for his medications.
By law, people in prison have a right to get the health care they need.
We'll hear arguments first this morning.
In the late 1970s, there was a famous Supreme Court case, Estelle v. Gamble, that set the standard for the medical rights of prisoners.
On February 7th and 8th, 1974, when he was in solitary confinement, he asked to go on sick call. He was refused permission to
It said people serving sentences should be granted health care that's equal to those in the immediate community beyond prison walls. But how that's defined and acted on is really left up to physicians, contractors, and medical directors at each facility. And Nick says many facilities are overcrowded, which means they're not providing adequate care. At the moment, prisons in the United States are about 104% over capacity.
If it's a problem of capacity, it's because the state did not provide adequate capacity.
Nick says, even under the best of circumstances, what medicine can deliver inside of prisons is limited. What's more important is to think about the issues that lead to mass incarceration and who is disproportionately affected by it. For example, in 2017, Black people represented 12% of the U.S. adult population, but 33% of the sentenced prison population.
Black people in this country are more likely to be incarcerated, more likely to be followed by police, more likely to end up in jail or prison, more likely to have a harsher and longer sentence.
That's Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein, a professor at the University of North Carolina who studies the impact of incarceration on health outcomes.
When you look at neighborhoods that have disproportionate levels of incarceration, those are the same communities that have less infrastructure for transportation, that have less number of clinics, have higher numbers of food deserts, right? So all these social determinants of health and access to healthcare put people at risk of having a higher burden of chronic illness.
And all the things that Lauren just mentioned tend to also lead to much higher levels of trauma. Nick remembers something the prison warden at his facility told him during his tenure at the Department of Corrections.
And he said that he had really never met an inmate who had a reasonable childhood. And of course, poverty is greatly overrepresented.
It's big picture issues that lead to mass incarceration in the U.S., social diseases like racism, disinvestments in public schools and local businesses, big systemic forces that restructure opportunity, particularly for Black and brown people who are overrepresented in the prison population.
So this would be like if people lived in the part of London where all the water came from the Broad Street pump, they would get cholera. And you couldn't fix that until you cut off the water from that pump. Our patients come from lives that lead to incarceration, and we need to figure out how to take the handle off of that pump.
And the cost of not addressing these problems is deeply felt.
The worst disease in corrections, actually, is incarceration. As bad as things are with so many diseases, incarceration is the overwhelming worst disease. It's really terrible. It wrecks your life. It distorts all of the relationships. It distorts the relationship with hope.
For Adnan, thinking about the broader circumstances that affected his life and the choices he made really resonates. By the time he was 18, his family life had completely deteriorated. After years of living with his abusive stepfather, his mother abandoned the family altogether.
I was a parentless, homeless high school dropout. In school, being treated as a quote-unquote bad kid, either sent to detention, suspension, expulsion, just the school-to-prison pipeline. All of that was contributing factor to the night where I committed my harm.
In 2003, he committed a robbery. He wasn't armed, but his accomplice ended up killing their victim. Adnan got a mandatory life sentence because of something called the felony murder rule, a law he was able to help overturn from prison, which paved the path to his release in 2019.
I don't know what to feel. I feel I'm going to wake up in the morning like, what? Where am I?
34-year-old Adnan Khan got his first taste of freedom Friday after a Contra Costa judge overturned his murder conviction and ordered his release from San Quentin prison.
When he got out, it felt like an opportunity to start over, to find a new beginning.
And because I didn't have the restrictions of parole or probation, I was able to quite literally be free, work where I needed to work, get housing where I needed to, where I felt like was comfortable and safe for me that the system didn't put me into.
Adnan says he still feels a bit of survivor's guilt. He was released just a year before the pandemic hit, but he's still finding moments of joy. In April 2020, Adnan and his wife Alex welcomed their firstborn, a baby boy.
Growing up, I come from a broken home, and I always said to myself, whenever I get older, I can't wait to do it right. I don't want to have a broken family. I want to have a wife, a home, and raise my child in a loving family, unlike my life. So just to be out, get freed from a life sentence, get married, and then now he's here is just, I can't tell you the layers of blessings and the joy that I feel and the miracle quite literally that I feel towards him and towards us as a family.
For The Pulse, I'm Sojourner Ahebe.